Okay, I have the homework created. Cooper, are you going to frame the homework?
Oh, yes.
Okay, good.
So I didn't frame this. It's done.
All right. I hereby officially bug you. Okay. All right, so today, does everybody have a copy of the notes now? Good. So what I'll talk about today is modular symbols. This is going to be essentially a theoretical overview of modular symbols, and also I'll give you a little bit of a deeper understanding of weight two modular forms. So we're leaving level one behind and going into really different terrain now. I won't talk about computational issues involving modular symbols really at all today or in much detail. That's what I'll do much more on Wednesday and Friday. So far in the class, we've talked a lot about MK SL2Z. And I explained how to compute MK SL2Z. One way is to, one observation was it decomposed as a direct sum of the subspace generated by the Eisenstein series EK and the cuspidal subspace SK. SL2Z. And moreover, you can get this whole thing using polynomials in E4 and E6, or equivalently G4 and G6. So that's what we did already. And what we'll talk about today, and actually for the rest of the week, is M2 gamma 0 of n. So things look a lot different here. So instead of considering level one, remember that gamma zero of one is SL2Z. We're now considering higher level, but weight two. And almost everything I'm going to say this week would apply almost verbatim with gamma zero replaced by gamma one. So the theory is very similar for those two groups. There are a few slight changes, but essentially everything's the same. But this is what we'll focus on. And just as before, there's a decomposition as a direct sum of as a direct sum of a subspace generated by Eisenstein series, which I'll call Eis2 gamma 0 of n. And just as in the case of level 1, you can write these down completely explicitly. There's a procedure that involves Bernoulli numbers and Dirichlet characters that allows you to just completely list all the elements of this space, or at least the basis of this space, in terms of generalized Eisenstein series. And then there's another subspace, the subspace of weight two cusp forms. And M2 is a direct sum of these two. Now, computing this again is similar to computing EK. And I'm going to talk about this in more generality later on. So for the rest of the week, we're going to focus entirely on how to compute S2 gamma 0 of n. And this is, in fact, probably the most interesting family of spaces of modular forms to consider. Because, there's a lot going on here. As I'll explain, but just a quick glimpse as to why this is so interesting. If you take any elliptic curve at all, E, defined over Q, elliptic curve, and you count the number of points on the elliptic curve, you let AP be P plus 1 minus the number of points on the curve, or you reduce the curve modulo P. And you can even make sense of this when E has bound reduction of P, then you have either P minus 1 P or P plus 1 points, depending on the type of reduction of the curve. But I won't go into detail about that. But you get a bunch of numbers A sub P, and then if you consider the formal product, let's see, let me just say this. So if you consider this formal product over all times p, and just expand it out, you get a sum a n over n to the s, where the a sub n, when n is prime, are exactly a sub p, and the a sub n for n composite, they're determined by a recurrence that's just completely determined by what I've written already. The only subtlety is that for the bad primes, you actually have to be a little, well, you just have to omit this factor. So, in fact, if I put epsilon of p to the 1 minus 2s, where epsilon is 1 when p doesn't divide the minimal discriminant of the elliptic curve, and it's 0 when p does divide the minimal discriminant of the elliptic curve, then this is completely correct, and it defines integers a sub n, one for each positive integer n. And that these numbers, if you put them together and consider f sub e, which is equal to sum a sub n q to the n, where here q is e to the 2 pi iz, and the sum goes from 1 to infinity, this gives you an element of s2 gamma 0 of n. Now, the fact that this is in here is an extremely deep theorem, called the modularity theorem. Brave, Conrad, Diamond, Taylor, and Wiles. But that just gives you an indication that this space of modular forms, the space of cusforms of weight 2 for gamma 0 of n, is somehow crucially central in number theory. And more generally, but I'll just stop there. So that's just an indication of how important these are. Now I want to give you a more geometric point of view on the definition of S2 gamma 0 of n. First, stepping back for a second, recall what I've already defined it for you to be. I've defined in complete generality as the definition of MK gamma, or gamma congruent subgroup, and SK gamma. So remember, SK gamma, the way I defined it at the beginning of the course, it's the collection of holomorphic functions on the extended upper half plane that transform under gamma in a certain way, that is F R gamma K equals F for all gamma in capital gamma. And also, the elements of the elements of SK gamma are supposed to vanish at each of the cusps. So that's the definition of SK gamma. It's a whole bunch of holomorphic functions on the upper half plane. H star actually vanishes at every cusp. And this other condition right here, F bar gamma equals F for all gamma and gamma. So that's the definition, but it's not a very satisfying definition in some sense, because it's very much just functions with some property. And it's possibly very difficult to get your head around a collection of functions with some property. It's like the set of solutions to some complicated equation. I mean, really, it is the set of solutions to some complicated equation. So it would be nice to have a different point of view that perhaps makes these a little more computable. In the case of level 1 and varying k, already this definition was enough to sort of narrow down the possibilities. And then we were able to just give a couple of example solutions, and they generated everything. But in the case of higher level, that's not what happens. So again, we're going to focus on S2 gamma 0 of n. And remember, this transformation condition had a different interpretation, at least when k is even, where I mentioned the differential. And particularly when k is 2, this transformation condition is just the condition that the differential f of z dz is invariant under replacing z by gamma of z. So you can put all the sort of same things here, but you can rewrite things a little bit. So f is holomorphic. It vanishes at the cusps. And f of z dz
is equal to f of gamma z d gamma of z, for all gamma in gamma 0 and n. And of course, you still need the condition. Well, actually, no, that's all I need.
But still, that's really not much of an improvement. And there is a way to improve this a lot, which is to consider the curve or the Riemann surface, x 0 of n. And this is what you get when you quotient the extended upper half plane out by the action of gamma 0 of n by linear fractional transformations. So you identify any two points of their equivalent under gamma 0 of n. And then you can then view S2 gamma 0 of n as simply the space of holomorphic differentials on X 0 of n. I mean, they're not exactly the same thing, because these are actually functions on the upper half plane, whereas a holomorphic differential is not a function on the upper half plane. But there's a bijection, a natural isomorphism between the holomorphic differentials on here and the cusp forms S2 gamma 0 of n, these functions on the upper half plane. And you have a map from the upper half plane extended to X 0 of n. And given a differential here, you can pull it back, and then it's of the form f of z dz, and then you take the f of z, and that's the corresponding function. So you can view S2 gamma 0 of n alternatively as, careful with my equals, as the space of holomorphic differentials on the Riemann surface, on the compact Riemann surface, x 0 of n. And there's various notations for this, and I'll use h 0, x 0 of n, comma omega. And a basic fact from the theory of Riemann surfaces is that the dimension as a complex vector space of the space of holomorphic differentials is the same as the genus of the compact Riemann surface. So this has dimension equal to the genus. And the genus, if you don't know, is just the number of holes in this compact Riemann surface. So I think I do that very well. So maybe I'll draw it here. So X mod of n, at least topologically, looks like a G-hold torus, where G, the number of holes, is the same as the dimension of S2 gamma 0 of n. Okay, any questions? Yes?
You said that the dimension of the holomorphic, the set of holomorphic,
yeah,
the genus of what?
Of what?
The genus of what?
The genus of X0 then, of this compact Riemann surface. So if you take the upper half plane, you find, say, a fundamental domain, you fold over the edges and glue them together that are identified under the action of the group, you get a compact Riemann surface. And that compact Riemann surface has a genus, which is the number of little holes in it that you can sort of tie a little string around. And that the number of holes is the same as the dimension of this space. Something I won't prove at all because it doesn't belong in this course, but it's sort of nice to keep in mind. And you can apply this, for example, in the case n equals 1. And there, does anybody remember, or so what happens if you take the upper half plane and quotient out by SL2z? What's the genus of the resulting Riemann surface? You're right, it's zero. It's a sphere, yeah. There's a fundamental domain that looks like this, and when you quotient out, you just sort of do a little gluing that gives you a sphere. So the genus there is zero, so the dimension of S2 gamma 0 of 1 is zero. And that's something we I pointed out directly using the valence formula before. So just recovering that. There aren't any modular forms of weight 2 and level 1. Okay, So this is just a little bit more geometric point of view on the definition of S2 gamma 0 of n. Instead of thinking of S2 gamma 0 of n as a bunch of functions on the upper half plane that transform in a certain way, etc., you can think about the elements of S2 gamma 0 of n essentially as being differentials on x 0 of n instead. Now, please.
Is there any simple formula for that genus?
Yes, there's a very simple, well, I can't remember it off the top of my head. It's not quite as simple as the formula for the genus or the dimension in the level 1 case, but it's essentially n over 12, just like in level 1 it was about k over 12. There's like a little bit of variation now, and the variation depends on little arithmetic functions, but it's very elementary to implement, say, a function to compute the dimension of this. And to derive a function, I mean, to derive a formula for the dimension is a fairly straightforward application of the Riemann-Roch theorem. You have a covering from x0 of n to x0 of 1. You know the genus of x0 of 1, and you can analyze the properties of that covering. And using Riemann-Roch, or more precisely Riemann-Hurwitz, you get a formula, and one of the things that comes out of it is the genus of this. So, yes?
Oh, I was wondering when you pushing out by SL2Z.
Yes.
It's fundamental to me. When you push out by the add one part, that glues the sides of the
Yes, because that's right.
How does the gluing work for the other generator, the minus one over Z?
Oh, well, it's gluing the bottom, I think, but I'll leave that as an exercise. Think about that. I think the bottom gets glued. Like the two,
because it seems like on the
bottom gets fixed by tau, but that edge does get glued somehow by the groove. So, but the result is compact. But that's good. Somehow that's reasonably. I would think about this more. Just have a lot to do. Yeah. Sorry. X0 of n, there are some sort of surprising ways to think about the points on x0 of n in terms of elliptic curves. And when you think about x0 of n from that point of view, you can get a nice definition of Heck operators, which is much more natural than the definition I gave before. And I'll show you what that is right now. Okay, so x0 of n, it's a compact Riemann surface over the complex numbers. Topologically, it looks like this. It's a theorem, I think, of Shimura that, in fact, it has an algebraic structure over Q. Canonical algebraic structure over Q. By that I mean that there is an algebraic curve defined over Q. You can write it down completely explicitly if you want to badly enough. And the set of complex points of that curve are exactly the, it's exactly this Riemann surface. And it has this interpretation, its points parametrize pairs. Like pairs E, comma C, where E is an elliptic curve and C is a cyclic subgroup of the elliptic curve of order N. It's a coarse moduli space for a certain moduli problem, which is to classify such pairs. And now I'll give you a much more precise statement. This is just a vague statement that you're supposed to think, okay, this just gives you a compartment to think about it. Much more precisely, here's what's really true. So inside of x0, then, there's an open subcurve, which is just got by taking The upper half plane, without adding in the cusps, modulo gamma 0 then. So this is not compact. And the points of this curve are in one-to-one bijection.
So I'll write down the statement. Y0 of n, its complex points are in natural one-to-one bijection. I'll tell you what the bijection is in a second. With pairs, an elliptic curve, E, defined over the complex numbers. So I'll just write over the complex numbers like that. And a cyclic subgroup C of the curve. And the C is as an abstract group isomorphic to, well, the cyclic of order n. I guess I should have put all this down here. And you take these modulo isomorphism. That's crucial. So a pair is isomorphic to another pair if there's an isomorphism of the corresponding elliptic curves that sends one subgroup to the other subgroup. And if you forget the up to isomorphism thing, then every calculation we do will probably be wrong. So it's very important to keep this in mind. So this is up to isomorphism. And it's actually a pretty simple correspondence. It's really nice. So here's how it works. The really easy direction is, given a point on y0 of n, I'll tell you how to write down an elliptic curve and a cyclic subgroup of order n. And then there's some question, what if you change that point and replace it by an equivalent representative? Do you get the same pair EC up to isomorphism? That's one of the homework problems. And you'll see why or how gamma 0 of n somehow has something to do with cyclic subgroups of order n when you do the homework problem. In any case, let me show you how this works. So the bijection works this way. What is y0 of n of c? It is just it's just a set of equivalence classes of the upper half plane modulo the action of gamma 0 of n. So to give a point on y0 of n is just to give an element of the upper half plane up to gamma 0 of n. So I'll just write that's the equivalence class modulo the action of gamma 0 of n on the upper half plane of the element lambda. Okay? So that's how you give a specific element of y0 of n. And again, lambda is just a complex number in the upper half plane. And I'll tell you how to take that and construct up to isomorphism a pair EC. Well, the elliptic curve is just C modulo lambda, where lambda is the lattice Z plus Z lambda. That is the lattice spanned by 1 in lambda. And that's an elliptic curve. Anytime you take a lattice, the complex numbers modulo a lattice, you get an elliptic curve, otherwise just P3. And the cyclic subgroup that you can take is 1 over capital N Z modulo lambda. Okay. And again, this is up to isomorphism. So this is an association that goes from elements of y0 of n to pairs. And the fact is that it goes both ways. It's a bijection, and it's well-defined. And the well-defined part will prove in your homework, one of the homework problems. Okay, any questions about this? Yes?
What's the up to isomorphism part?
It's an isomorphism of pairs EC. Is an isomorphism of elliptic curves from E to E prime that, moreover, it's not just an isomorphism of the elliptic curves, but it has to send C onto C prime. Okay? So the situation mainly where this turns out to be really important is, well, there are a couple of cases. One is when n equals 2. Every elliptic curve has an isomorphism from it to, from itself to itself, which is multiplication by minus 1. And that preserves your cyclic subgroup of order 2. So when capital N equals 2, you have that extra isomorphism. But more generally, for complex multiplication elliptic curves, you have of J invariant 0, 17, 28, you have extra isomorphisms like from the curve to itself that, depending on the size of your group, may or may not be preserved. But if they are preserved, then you know, you have some extra identification of points. Okay? And also just, I mean, if you, well, and you can also imagine two elliptic curves that are given by different lattices, say this lattice and twice this lattice, but they're isomorphic as elliptic curves. So that's another thing. By the way, a very handy fact to keep in mind when working with elliptic curves over C is that a homomorphism of elliptic curves over the complex numbers, if they're presented via lattices, so if this defines one elliptic curve and this defines another one, a homomorphism is simply a complex linear map from C to C, that is multiplication by a complex number, that sends lambda into lambda prime. So that's exactly what a homomorphism is of elliptic curves over C. So it's actually really easy to work with them. So I've sort of told you all the ingredients you need to do the first homework problem. But the neat thing is that now that you have this alternative interpretation of y0 of n, the Heck operators can be defined, or I will define the Heck operators in a very natural way. So watch. Before I do that, though, any questions? Okay, so now Heck operators. So here's a really central diagram. So fix, say, a prime number p that doesn't divide n. And consider x0 np. Or just to keep ourselves in the context we're used to, let's just say y0 np for the moment.
N times p.
Yes, n times p, just the product of these two integers. Now, there's two natural ways of mapping y0 np to y0 n. One way, well, if you view the elements of y0 of np as pairs, an elliptic curve, and a cyclic subgroup of order np, one way is to send ec, I'm going to get the order right, not that it really matters, I'm going to do it the same as in my notes. So one way is to... So given a cyclic group of order np, it has a unique cyclic subgroup of order n. So you just send ec to the same elliptic curve, but we replace the cyclic subgroup of order np by the unique cyclic subgroup of order n. That's what I mean by this. I guess you could write p times c. So this is a group of order n, and it's the unique one. So that's one way to do it. Another way is to quotient out by the unique subgroup of order p. You get a different elliptic curve and a different subgroup, but that subgroup has order n now. So here this d is the unique subgroup of order p. So I could also write that as n times c. Okay, so those are two different ways, and I'll call this one pi 2 and the other one pi 1. Now, these extend naturally to maps of compact Riemann surfaces or algebraic curves with the x's. So you actually get maps from x0 of n, p to x0 of n, and x0 of n, p to x0 of n. And there's a notion of pullback of differentials. So if you take a differential of x0 of n, pull it back via this map, then push it forward via the other map, the resulting composition is a map on differentials from x0 of n to x0 of n. And that is the Heck operator TP. I didn't exactly define the Heck operators on weight 2 form, or on a higher level, but the definition's just like what I gave for level 1. So the induced map, is pi 2 upper star composed of pi 1 lower star, pull back composed of push forward on differentials, which I can identify with S2 gamma 0 n. This is the Heck operator T2. TP, not T2, TP. So you can think of the Heck operators geometrically as pull back and then push forward. It's a lot of work to, it's sort of a tedious amount of work to show that this definition agrees with the analog of the definition I gave earlier. I gave a definition earlier, you just take F and you sum over the action of certain matrices on F. And that also makes sense for higher level, and it agrees with this definition. And then all of these agree with the definition on Q expansions. Now another really important connection between, or reason for introducing x0 of n and viewing it as an algebraic curve of compact Riemann surface, is that there's an integration pairing between the homology of x0 of n and the differentials on x0 of n. So more precisely, if you consider the space H lower 1 X naught of N Z, which is something I'm going to make incredibly concrete for you in the remainder of this week, then something I'll say a little more about the definition of in a moment. This is the integral, first integral homology of this topological space. You can pair it with differentials, which I'm identifying with cusp forms, with S2 gamma 0 of N. And given one of those, given a differential, or a cusp form, and an integral homology class, you get a complex number. Actually, I'll just write it for a moment as on the differential. So if you view the homology class as, say, gamma, and the differential as omega, then this map is supposed to be integral of omega along half gamma. And it's a perfect, it's a non-degenerate pairing, and if you replace the z by r, you get a perfect pairing. But again, this can be identified with cusp forms, as we did, or this is identified with cusp forms, and you have this pairing. The Heck operators act on the homology also. Since I've defined them in this nice geometric way, if you have a homology class on x0 of n, you can pull it back and push it forward, and you get a homology class on x0 of n again. And that association, that pull it back and push forward operation, that also defines a Heck operator TP on homology. And the really neat thing is that this pairing respects the action of the Heck operators. That is to say, if you act via a Heck operator on a homology class and then pair, it's the same as taking that Heck operator and not acting, but acting on the differential, i.e. on the modular form, and then pairing. You can pair on either side, so it's Heck equivariant in that sense. TP gamma omega is equal to gamma TP omega. And this turns out to be incredibly useful because H1 x0 of n z, there's a very powerful algorithm for computing this, and it's somehow much easier to understand for certain problems than H0 x0 of n omega, than the cusp forms. And because you have this perfect pairing, if you can compute a basis of this and matrices for the action of Heck operators on this, on the homology, you can actually read off almost anything that you could read off about this space. using this duality. I mean, after all, this homology is just the collection of homomorphisms from the homology to C. So if you can understand homology, then you must be able to recover this. Okay, so I'll say a little more about, or a lot more actually, about the homology H1 X0 of NC. For example, I'm going to tell you what it is. So one of the is H1 X0 of N. So I don't know how much algebraic topology any of you have seen, but I'll assume very little. Well, given a, well, just view X0 then as a topological space. So that's really what I'm drawing on the board when I draw this. It's when you can really sit inside of R3. And consider all of the maps, well, consider all maps from S1 the circle into the space, and you get these little loops. So just think of all possible ways of mapping the circle in here, and then all linear combinations of such maps, and with signs, z linear combinations of such maps, and that gives you one chains, and then you take all the boundaries of disks, and you quotient out by those, and you get H1 X dot of NZ. But here's a more concrete way to think about it. I'll do it just in the case of genus 1 for starters. So suppose that X0 of N has genus 1. So topologically, it's a torus. Then there are two ways of mapping, there's two ways of putting a circle, of embedding a circle in this topological space. And these two ways are, there's no way to get from one to the other where the difference of the two is a boundary of a two simplex. So these two are inequivalent. And in this case, H1X0 of NZ is the free abelian group on a loop going around that way, and generated by these two things, a loop going around one way and a loop going around the other. So in general, this is, I mean, it's really hard to say because there's so much language that I'm assuming, that I can't really assume you have. If I assume you don't know this already, if I'm going to tell you at all, I might as well. I'll not tell you. I mean, given what. Actually, wait, hold on. So who knows enough? Like, who is completely mystified by the definition of this, and who sort of already knows this? Because I'm having trouble explaining anything because I don't know what level A at.
So how does this relate? Like, is this fundamental group, the H1?
It's a abelianization, I think.
Okay.
The fundamental group is non-abelian.
It's like a nice version of the fundamental group.
Yeah. What?
Why don't you get past the torus?
Yeah, the torus, for example, but in general, it's the abelianization of the fundamental group. It's easier than homotopy. Yes?
I had a question about the definition of hash operators.
Sure.
So you pull back the differential by pi 2?
Yes.
And then you push it forward by pi 1?
Yeah.
I've never pushed forward a differential.
Okay. The pushing forward one's easier than pulling back, but to answer that question, I think I have to be more precise about what I mean by a differential on each of these, and let's see how I can do that. So how about if we think explicitly about one of these two maps as a map on the upper half plane, and then you know what a differential is on the upper half plane, it's just f of z dz, and locally differentials on here are just differentials on the upper half plane because these are, after all, they have their complex structure coming from the upper half plane. So each of these maps is induced by a map on the upper half plane, or from the upper half plane to itself. And let's see, I guess we can start with, which one should we do? I think this is the easier one. Yeah, this is the easier one. So, hold on a second. Okay, so x0 of np, or y0 of np, is the upper half plane modulo gamma 0 of np, and y0 of n is the upper half plane modulo gamma 0 of n, and there's a map like this, and I gave a geometric interpretation. I'm just going to talk about pi 2 because I think it's a little bit easier. I gave a geometric interpretation of pi 2 as you take the pair of EC and you map it to E mod NC, C mod NC. And that corresponds to something here, and that actually corresponds to something from H to H. So given the gamma, I'll call it lambda like before, that represents an element in here. I think that pi 2 is just given by lambda goes to p lambda. I have to make sure that's right. The elliptic curve that corresponds to lambda is c mod z plus z lambda, and the cyclic subgroup is 1 over nz plus minus lambda plus mod lambda, and this is c mod z plus zp lambda, and then the cyclic subgroup in the first case is you just take the image of the other cyclic subgroup, so it's again generated by 1 over n. So 1 over n z mod, but now the lambda is z plus zp lambda. And let's see. So, oh wait, I have to be careful. This is 1 over np, and this is 1 over n. Okay, so, let's see. Just going to see if this is right. Actually, So I'm supposed to mod out by n times the cyclic subgroup. And what is n times this? It's 1 over p. So n times the cyclic subgroup is the subgroup generated by 1 over p. So the question is this the same as quotient out by that? I think it is. I have to think about that. So the reason, it is the same because if we consider the elliptic curve c mod z plus z times p lambda, there's an isomorphism to, which is this multiplication by 1 over p, a complex linear map from c to c. There's an isomorphism from here to c mod 1 over p z plus z lambda. And this is exactly this elliptic curve up here, c mod z plus z lambda, but modded out by 1 over pz. So we've thrown in n times the cyclic subgroup. So this is what I've written right here is exactly e modulo n times c, modulo the unique subgroup of order p. So completely explicitly on the upper half plane, pi 2 is lambda goes to p lambda. Okay. So now your question was pushing for differentials. So instead of telling you about pi 1, I'll tell you about pi 2, just because I was easily able to describe pi 2 completely explicitly as a function on the upper half plane, pull it back to the upper half plane.
So now, suppose you have a differential f of z dz, a differential on gamma 0 of n p sigma h. That seemed the right kind of. So this is y 0 of n p.
How do you push it forward? How do you get a differential on y 0 of n?
Using the map induced by, since I'm using z here, I better call it z, using the map induced by z goes to pz.
So I think it's just f of pz pz. So that's I'll run it throughout this. There's always one direction which is easy on this part. Now it's actually more complicated. So the one going back is in the other direction. So going from a differential on y0 and then pulling back to y0 at np is just f of z goes to f of pz. So that's the first part of this. Okay? So I told you about pi 2. So pulling back by pi 2 ends up being equivalent to f of z goes to f of pz, which corresponds to replacing q by q to the p. Going in the other direction is like a tracing operation, and it involves selecting, remember the matrices that I used to define the Heck operators before, a couple of days ago? You write down exactly those matrices, and they're exactly what you need to provide a trace, which goes from differentials on gamma 0 of NP back to differentials on gamma 0 of N. And that's what will happen when you push forward in the other direction. So it's that you're going to end up summing over a bunch of matrices, and those matrices are exactly summing up the action of a bunch of matrices on your differential, and those matrices are exactly the same as the matrices that I used to define the Heck operators before. So in fact, if you unwind the definition of pull back and push forward, you'll just end up finding the same definition of Heck operator that I gave before. But pushing forward is a trace. Did I answer that enough, or?
Yeah, I'll budget.
Okay, so back to homology. So I'm not sure what I should tell you more about homology. It's simply, it's just you have a topological space, and you consider all of the linear combinations, z-linear combinations of closed loops, closed paths on the topological space modulo. Two are equivalent if you can deform from one to the other, where their difference is the boundary of the image of a two simplex. I mean, it's hard to say much more if you don't just go through an algebraic topology course. Okay. So I guess that's almost everything I wanted to say. I wanted to define modular symbols, but I'll do that at the beginning next time. They're simply a completely explicit way of presenting homology classes so that it's explicit. (Clears throat)